Hello and welcome to No Character Limit. My name is Robert Thurk, and today you're going to hear episode 22 of my book entitled Ultima Thule, Unraveling the Unknown. In this episode, as well as the next, I'm going to cover all of chapter 14, called Cosmic Real Estate. This was the chapter that I didn't know I needed to write until I started researching meteorites. I found the topics of property, ownership, collection, as well as the buying and selling of meteorites, fascinating. Questions such as, who owns a meteorite when only a moment before nobody did? Is it a finder's keeper's sort of situation, or is there more to it? What does the law say? And how do you determine a financial value to something that is essentially priceless? And what meteorites have we as a species placed more value on than others? And who hunts meteorites, and what is their life actually like? Over the next two episodes, I'm going to take you on a bit of a wild ride in regards to answering these questions. And at least for me, there was a lot of what I'm about to share with you that was unknown and unexpected to learn. In this episode, I'm going to discuss the issue of ownership, as well as the scientific and financial value of different types of meteorites, as well as talk about some influential players in the market. In the next episode, I'm going to share some of the most interesting stories I found in relation to valuable meteorites, as well as some of the world's most expensive collections. And I want to share one resource that I really found well-written and well-done that I used for this episode. It's an article written for Science Magazine called Lucky Strike, which was actually the article that got me interested in writing this whole chapter to begin with. It's in my sources, and it's definitely worth a full read if you've got the time, as I only pull bits and pieces from it. And as always, please like, rate, review, or tell a friend if you've been enjoying this podcast to help increase the amount of listeners. You could also give a donation. I provide a free PDF copy of my book for any donation size that you choose to give. You can always follow me at nocharacterlimit@mastodon.world, and you can always reach out to me at nocharacterlimit@protonmail.com. So now let's get into the business of meteorites. Chapter 14, Cosmic Real Estate. Chapter 14, Cosmic Real Estate. Part 1, Raining Money, the Sylacauga and Aguas Zarcas Meteorites. For all of the beauty, shock, and awe meteor showers provide, they very rarely result in an actual meteorite deposited onto Earth. Hence, the space missions to comets. Rocks that do reach Earth are almost entirely comprised of asteroids, planetary cores, or the surfaces of other planets. In Ensisheim, one boy had the incredibly rare privilege to witness the impact occur with his own eyes. Even more rare is being struck by one. On November 30th, 1954, at about 2:46 p.m., people across Alabama reported seeing a bright reddish light that was like a Roman candle trailing smoke shoot across the afternoon sky. Ann Hodges of Sylacauga, Alabama, was oblivious to all of this at the time, as she was napping on her sofa. But in an instant, a rock tore through her roof, crashed into her radio console, and bounced against the side of her stomach, where she developed a large, dark bruise where it hit her. In the ensuing chaos, Ann and her mother thought that their chimney had collapsed as dust and debris suddenly filled their home. Ann Hodges became the only known human in recorded history to be hit by a meteorite, since there is a better chance of getting hit by a tornado, bolt of lightning, and a hurricane all at the same time than there is to be hit by a meteorite, according to one Florida State College astronomer. The police and fire department were called as people began to gather around the Hodges residence, much to the surprise of her husband when he returned home from work later that day. Questions swirled about whether it was a piece of airplane debris, an unusual attack from the Soviet Union, or a meteorite. A geologist was even being called to the scene to investigate the big news in this sleepy southern town. Hodges was hospitalized and later released to allow her meteorite welt to heal. The bewildering account of the Hodges meteorite made national news and created a bit of a sensation. And at some point after Hodges returned home, the inevitable question of ownership came up. Since the Hodges rented their home, the landlady claimed ownership over the meteorite, an offensive stance to the woman who was just nearly killed by it. "Suing is the only way she'll ever get it," Hodges stated bluntly. "I think God intended it for me. After all, it hit me." But this view was not shared by the courts, and Hodges ended up having to pay her landlady $500 in order to keep the meteorite. After all of the media hype and attention that Anne received, the Hodges thought that they could sell the meteorite for much more. But strangely, they couldn't find a buyer. Despite the initial sensation, America quickly moved on, and the interest in her bizarre story no longer captured much attention. The Hodges kept the meteorite for a while before donating it to the Alabama Museum of Natural History. Officially, the meteorite that hit Ann Hodges has been called the Sylacauga meteorite, a common chondrite, and therefore estimated to be about as old as the solar system itself. It also turns out the Sylacauga meteorite broke apart in the air into at least two pieces. The media hype directly following the Hodges strike also reached a farmer in the same area whose mules had balked at an unusual black rock in the road earlier on that same day, which he remembered pushing out of the road before moving on. The farmer went back to the spot and brought home the 4.6 billion year old rock and let his kids play with it while he contacted a lawyer to help him sell it. Ultimately, this farmer made enough money from it to buy a house and a car. This second piece of the Sylacauga meteorite found its way to the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. Together, the piece that hit Hodges and the piece found by the farmer weighed over 10 pounds. And in 2017, a 10-gram piece of the meteorite from the Smithsonian sold at an auction for $7,500. With the Hodges unable to find a buyer for their meteorite, and the nearby farmer able to sell his piece for enough to purchase a house and a car, it begs the question, what is the true value of a meteorite? In 2017, the price of that dime-sized run-of-the-mill chondrite sold for over 18 times its weight in gold. But this unusual fragment, the only meteorite known to have hit a human being, is special not because of what it is comprised of, but instead its story. Therefore, the novel way that each meteorite came to Earth can raise the value of a meteorite. Unlike earthly metals and rocks, there are no mining facilities setting market prices to these rare rocks, and so their market is entirely unique. It turns out the buying and selling of meteorites is also a lucrative business filled with colorful and unusual characters. Science magazine wrote a fascinating article on the topic of the meteorite business entitled Lucky Strike, which you can find in the sources of this podcast. The article begins very similarly to the story of Anne Hodges with an ominous rumble in the sky and the sudden confusing debris inside of a home. The difference was that this time the location was Costa Rica. The year was 2019 and nobody was struck by the rock. The meteorite, with a total weight of about 60 pounds, split up into nearly 30 pieces over the span of about 4 miles nearby the town of Aguas Zarcas. The Aguas Zarcas meteorite was different from the Sylacauga meteorite in another crucial way. It was a carbonaceous chondrite, one of those rare specimens outside of comets that carry those essential ingredients for life. Carbonaceous chondrites are especially important to collect as soon as possible after their fall, as contamination from Earth can leave any scientific discoveries questionable. The Science Magazine article explains, quote, "From the instant the rock entered the atmosphere, the clock began to tick. Clays, its major constituent, soak up surrounding air and water like a sponge. Earthly amino acids and other organic compounds intrude layer by layer, followed by the microbes that produce them, each second in contact with moist rainforest soil or human hands destroys more information. Ideally, we pluck it out of the air while it's coming down, says Ashley King, a planetary scientist at London's Natural History Museum, whilst wearing gloves. End quote. The day after the fall at Aguas Zarcas, meteorite dealer Mike Farmer saw pictures from the previous day's crash on social media and quickly hopped the first flight to Costa Rica with $50,000 cash. On his layover there, he was already being contacted about whether he wanted to purchase one of the meteorites that fell through a doghouse. This same meteorite would later be featured on Werner Herzog's documentary, Fireball. Farmer met up with another meteorite dealer, Robert Ward, and together bought these meteorites for, according to the Science Magazine article, much too cheaply, the family now realizes. But after realizing the value of Aguas Zarcas, Farmer gave the family more money, and even became a family friend. Learning that there was money to be made in finding pieces of the Aguas Zarcas meteorite, locals began combing the surrounding rainforest for pieces. As collectors from all around the world descended on the town that was, until this event, relatively unknown, the value of each piece began to rise exponentially, from a few dollars per gram to over $100 per gram. At this point, Aguas Zarcas was still less valuable than the Sylacauga meteorite, which had been sold 2 years earlier for over $700 per gram. Although scientists from the University of Costa Rica were called and allowed to do an initial inspection of some of the samples, the buying frenzy from the free market meteorite business kept the university from acquiring a substantial piece for themselves. And before long, most of the meteorite was exported out of the country, which gives rise to questions about ethical behavior when collecting meteorites. The article then dives into the unusual laws that govern meteorites in a variety of countries, with some considering them national treasures that can't be exported, while others allow for unrestricted buying and selling. But the majority of places don't have any clear guidelines about what to do with discovered meteorites at all. This can lead to big legal gray areas that meteorite hunters are forced to confront, for better or worse. As the buying frenzy continued in Aguas Zarcas, prices for the meteorite rose to over $400 per gram, leaving Farmer and Ward increasingly strapped for cash. One wealthy Indianapolis collector and weight loss doctor, Jay Piatek, arrived in Aguas Zarcas clearly understanding the value of such a rare carbonaceous chondrite. He offered premium pricing for pieces of the rock, frustrating the meteorite-collecting duo Farmer and Ward, who Piatek claimed were taking advantage of people. But the money the locals received for the meteorites went to pay off debts, start a restaurant, fix up houses, and buy cars. Farmer, for his part, was able to return back to the United States with over 15 pounds of Aguas Zarcas, and provided some samples to Arizona State University. ASU has agreed to store some of farmers' samples in pristine nitrogen clean rooms, while other pieces are merely kept in Ziploc bags. Farmer plans to hold on to them for a while with the expectation that the price will increase once samples become less available to buy. At least one resident, the one whose house it had fallen into, kept a sizable chunk of aguas zarcas for herself instead of selling it. Chapter 14, Part 2. Carbonaceous chondrites. Murchison, a valuable chemical cocktail. Aguas zarcas' size and classification as a carbonaceous chondrite puts it on par with one of the most rare and valuable scientific meteorites to date, the 1969 Murchison meteorite. At around 11 a.m. on September 28, 1969, in the small town of Murchison, Australia, a loud, explosive sound cut through the sky, spooking dairy cows and causing runaway speculation at that morning's church service. It was witnessed in the sky, and an unusual scent of methylated spirits filled the air. As pieces began to be discovered, the local newspaper and police were notified, who then contacted geologists to come and inspect the rock. Professor John Lovering of the University of Melbourne was bringing moon rocks to Australia for study when he had heard of the fall in Murchison. A few days later, he laid eyes upon a sample which was brought into a TV studio in a bloated plastic bag due to gas being produced by the meteorite. He stated that he opened it up and instantly got the smell of all of these very complex organic compounds, an incredible potpourri of all the smells you've ever imagined. Immediately, Lovering knew he was looking at a carbonaceous chondrite. Two boys, the Gillick brothers, aged 10 and 11, were the most determined Murchison meteorite hunters to emerge after the fall. Their mother would take them out to different areas to search, and together they were able to recover over a third of the meteorite. The Gillick family even allowed scientists like Lovering to stay and search with them. While the Gillicks donated and exchanged some of the stones they discovered, they also sold some, but refused to say publicly how much they were paid for the samples. In total, the meteorite was a massive 220 pounds before it broke up over Murchison, larger than even Aguas Zarcas. Like Murchison, Aguas Zarcas had the characteristic chemical scent of a carbonaceous chondrite. In the Science Magazine article, the author was able to get a whiff of Aguas Zarcas. Quote, "I pick up the smell of moist soil with an artificial edge reminiscent of permanent marker. Garvey's official report describes a Murchison-like odor with notes of compost. Others compare it to Brussels sprouts or describe something sweet and organic, like diesel, cooking gas, or even vanilla. End quote. Studying the Murchison meteorite revealed its astounding age, somewhere between 4.6 and 7.5 billion years old. It's well understood that our solar system is 4.571 billion years old, and the run-of-the-mill chondrites that fall from the sky are often dated at such an age, having been around since the beginning and forged in the throes of our birthing star. Many comets as far out as the Oort cloud are comprised of rocks that were also heated up in the early solar system. So to find a meteorite like Murchison that is comprised of material that existed from a time before our sun is a truly special find. Remnants of a Milky Way that didn't consist of the only star we've ever truly known. In order to find out whether a meteorite is older than the solar system, it needs to be inspected closely. Scientists look for tiny pre-solar grains, such as nanodiamonds and silicon carbides, according to the Museums Victoria, which holds some of the Murchison meteorite. Murchison is filled with nearly uncontaminated elements from stars that lived their entire lives for millions or even billions of years before the sun even began to form. Aguas Zarcas confirmed the Murchison findings of a previous ancient generation of stars that existed in this region of space before the sun, giving us the elements that are found in our solar system today. Then there is the fact that Murchison contains over 100 amino acids, nucleobases, and even the sugar molecule ribose, all of the essential components for life. There are tens of thousands of organic compounds in Murchison, if not millions. One chemist studying Murchison said that the chemical composition is more complex than petroleum, a completely organic material. Murchison is so rich in complexity, it is still providing surprises for scientists over 50 years later, with some predicting that it will be revealing further insight into the universe for decades to come. Like comets, carbonaceous chondrites are possible culprits for delivering the necessary materials for life on Earth. Japan and the United States are both in the process of missions to the asteroids Ryugu and Bennu in hopes to get the purest samples of carbon-rich space material yet. So pure, they would never even touch the Earth's atmosphere, even after being brought to Earth, much like the Stardust mission. These missions, however, will not make Murchison or Aguas Zarcas any less valuable. Astrobiologist Daniel Glavin at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center said that he wouldn't have a job without Murchison. Philip Heck, curator of the meteorite collection at Chicago's Field Museum, said, quote, "If I had to start a new museum collection for meteorites, and I could only select two, I would choose Murchison and Aguas Zarcas. And if I could only choose one, I would choose Aguas Zarcas," end quote. The fact that Aguas Zarcas is so much more recent than Murchison makes it more appealing, along with the fact that there's so much more yet to study about it. Aguas Zarcas has already stymied some scientists by not containing a similar number of amino acids as Murchison. But like Murchison, it will likely be providing more insight into the solar system and its creation for decades to come. Chapter 14, Part 3, The Iron Price, Willamette and Gibeon Meteorites. You don't have to be a scientist to get your hands on a piece of any of these famous meteorites. Pieces of Aguas Zarcas between 0.08 and 0.3 grams were being sold on meteorite exchanges in 2020 for what would be the equivalent of about $200 per gram. But finding pieces of the much older Murchison for sale is more difficult. While some are willing to part with pieces of their Murchison, they typically require you to inquire about purchasing it rather than list a price. But while meteorites like Murchison and Aguas Zarcas are scientifically valuable, they are certainly nowhere near the priciest on the market. There is a Hollywood of meteorites, where unassuming carbonaceous chondrites like Murchison and Aguas Zarcas are often overlooked for the more flashy and attractive ones. Exotic meteorites, famous for their entrance into Earth. Beautiful meteorites that can't help but draw the eye. Sculpted meteorites merging mortal and cosmic art. Aristocratic meteorites that hail from parent bodies of high repute. It is not surprising, then, that such meteorites have drawn the attention of some of the world's most famous people. Steven Spielberg, Nicolas Cage, Yo-Yo Ma, and Elon Musk are all said to be collectors of these space rocks, whose presence on Earth are incredibly scarce. Some of the world's most powerful auction houses, such as Bonhams and Christie's, have regular meteorite auctions featuring some of these exotic beauties. In 2017, Christie's sold an original work of Leonardo da Vinci, known as Salvator Mundi, for $400 million. And while meteorites don't pull in that kind of money, there are still many that only the wealthiest can afford. Many of these auctions that took place remain on their website with striking images of sold meteorites. A 3-inch fragment of the only known meteorite to have taken a life when it pulverized the neck and shoulder of a cow sold on Bonhams for $1,553. One chondrite piece, small enough to fit in someone's fist, was recovered after crashing through someone's home and was sold on Bonhams with a piece of the rusted corrugated roof that it tore through and the dinged-up rice cooker that it hit for $4,075 in 2020. In 2007, Bonham sold a large pebble-sized achondrite meteorite from Mars for $16,730, found in the Sahara Desert only 2 years prior. One iron meteorite, about 8 inches in length, found in Morocco, sold for $20,000 in 2016 on Christie's. And these aren't even the notable meteorites, merely just the B-list celebrities of the meteoric world. Irons can bring in more money than the average meteorite. One need look no further than the Willamette meteorite. Weighing a total of 30,000 pounds, it is the largest meteorite found in North America and the sixth largest in the world. Landing in Canada about 13,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age, the large iron meteorite was moved by glaciers to the upper Willamette Valley of Oregon. Having been there for the entirety of the Holocene era, the Willamette's iron sulfide deposits produce sulfuric acid when mixed with rainwater, and has since eroded the boulder to give it its classic pitted look. It's really a beautiful meteorite, and I share a bunch of pictures of it in my book. A local tribe known as the Clackamas had apparently known that the meteorite, which they called Tamanoos, came from the sky, and it was considered a sacred rock going back to before recorded history. They believed the water collected within its cratered surface to be sacred, and would even dip their arrowheads in the water for its divine properties. But as the United States expanded in the 1850s, the Clackamas, along with over 20 other tribes, were relocated to the Grand Ronde Reservation, where they still regard the meteorite as sacred, despite no longer having access to it. Coincidentally, in 1902, a man rediscovered it on what had become the property of the Oregon Iron and Steel Company. He then used an old horse and his son to move the behemoth nearly a mile over the course of 3 months to get it to his front yard. And there, he built a shed around it and charged a quarter for people to come and view it. The theft was noticed by the neighboring iron and steel company, which then sued to get it back. The court cases involved in this debate of ownership gave the famed meteorite its first dollar amount value, a mere $150. However, as the appeals continued to wend their way through the court system, it was assessed again for $10,000, beginning Willamette's meteoric rise in price. While the ownership of the meteorite was being settled in court, it was being guarded by the county sheriff in his own front yard to keep under close surveillance. The meteorite had become so popular that when the sheriff slept, people eager to get a piece of the valuable iron snuck over to his house and tried to hammer pieces of it off, waking the sheriff, who then chased the trespassing thieves from his lawn. Ultimately, the Oregon Iron and Steel Company was granted ownership to the meteorite and sold it to a wealthy New Yorker, who then immediately sold it to the American Museum of Natural History in 1906. Willamette can still be visited today at the world-famous New York City Museum, the star attraction in the Rose Center. It took nearly a century before the tribes of Grand Ronde formally complained about the loss of the meteorite from them, claiming ownership of it before the Oregon Iron and Steel Company. The Oregon Iron and Steel Company was able to profit off of their sacred meteorite in exactly the same way as the company's neighbor tried to profit from it, neither of them respecting the Native American claim. In 1999, the Grand Ronde tribes made an effort to have the museum return the meteorite to them. The following year, as a compromise, the museum recognized the spiritual relationship of the meteorite to the Grand Ronde tribes, and in return, the Grand Ronde tribes respected the mission of the museum to preserve and protect the meteorite for all. Together, the museum and Grand Ronde came together with an amicable agreement where each year the Grand Ronde tribes are allowed to privately visit and hold a ceremony with the meteorite in return for dropping the attempt to bring the meteorite back to Oregon. Also in the agreement is that if the meteorite is ever taken off of display for anything other than reasonable purposes, it must then be returned to the tribes of Grand Ronde. Catherine Harrison of the Grand Ronde Tribal Council stated, quote, "Since the termination of our tribe by the federal government in 1954, we have worked hard to gather our people together to share our unique and important past. This agreement goes even further because it looks towards our future. I consider it one of the outstanding milestones we've reached for our tribal members." End quote. Then, in 2002, the Grand Ronde tribes had found out that the museum had cut off a 28-pound chunk of the meteorite back in 1998, and that a 3.4-ounce piece of that chunk had just sold at Bonham's auction for $11,000. Although the piece had been cut from the main bulk several years before the agreement between the museum and the Grand Ronde, the tribal council had not been aware that it had happened until the news of the auction reached them years after the agreement. Once again, Catherine Harrison of the council spoke for the tribes, this time expressing shock and dismay about their sacred meteorite being cut up and sold, and attempted to make a cultural comparison. Quote, "Would someone want to auction off a crucifix, one of the holy statues of the Catholic Church, or something like that?" End quote. Oregon's largest newspaper, the Oregonian, shared in the outrage of their local rock being handled by its East Coast curators, stating that if they had their way, it would be heading back on the next westbound freight train due to the museum's disgraceful stewardship. But it was not the museum that had auctioned the 3.4-ounce piece of the 28-pound chunk of meteorite for the $11,000. They had given it away in exchange for another meteorite, only a mere few ounces in size, the Governardo Valladares, which is a piece of one of those rare confirmed achondrites from Mars. Museums work very much like zoos, where dollar amounts on the rare or exclusive leads to the problem of putting a dollar value on something that is essentially priceless. To get around this issue, museums and zoos have a long history of trading one priceless possession for another. Especially when one place has a deficit in a certain exhibit and another has a surplus. This sort of trading is regular behavior for any museum, but the man who could provide the museum with a rare piece of Martian meteorite did not work for another museum. Well, not exactly. Daryl Pitt is the curator for one of the largest private meteorite collections in the world, called the Makovic Collection. The Makovic Collection has a reputation for not just being one of the largest collections, but also consisting of some of the top-tier meteorites found from all over the world. With this collection, Pitt has been able to become a main supplier when celebrities or big spenders want some of the most valuable meteorites available. When Pitt was willing to exchange the Governador Valladares for just a mere slice of the Willamette, the American Museum of Natural History saw this as a great way to expand their collection without losing anything substantial, and made the trade. But Pitt straddles the world between collector and businessman, willing to sell meteorites when there is the right demand. Something that museums will rarely do, since profit is not the motivation. Responding to the outrage from Oregon about the selling of a piece of Willamette, Pitt had little to say in response, stating, quote, "This is not anything that is unusual," end quote. Since the 2002 auction, small fragments of the Willamette meteorite have found their way back to the Grand Ronde tribes, most recently in 2019, where a 4.5 ounce of the Makovic collection was returned to them by the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum. These auctions have helped put a price tag on the entire 30,000-pound meteorite, and in 2007, one estimate put the price of the American Museum of Natural History's famous Central Core at $1.3 million, with the Makovic piece valued at about $85,000. The fragments returned to the tribe, while valued in the thousands of dollars, do not compare to what still remains outside of their hands. Another iron meteorite housed in the Arthur Ross Hall of Meteorites at the American Museum of Natural History is a piece of the Gibeon meteorite. It came plummeting through the atmosphere with a mass of over 50,000 pounds, breaking up over what is today Namibia, about 30,000 years ago, making its entrance to Earth twice as long ago as Willamette. Over the course of the 19th century, colonizing Europeans noticed large chunks of meteorite on their farm fields, and pieces of it weighing hundreds of pounds began working their way into collections all across the world, including the American Museum of Natural History. Currently, there are over 150 pieces of the Gibeon meteorite floating around the world. Namibia hosts 30 fragments alone in their capital of Windhoek, all of notable size. Another piece, over 700 pounds, can be found in Germany's famous Max Planck Institute. And, of course, the Gibeon has found its way into the Makovic collection, too. If Mike Farmer and Robert Ward represent the front line of meteorite collection, Daryl Pitt is in the corporate office, rarely going out to search for meteorites on his own. In a Forbes article from 2012, where the writer gets a rare tour of the Makovic collection, Pitt said that generally he gets his pieces through museums, like he did with the piece of Willamette, or from African tribal chiefs, but he didn't go into further detail about that source. That same year, Pitt attempted to sell a large cratered chunk of the Gibeon for $175,000, claiming that it looked like the face of the famous painting from Munch's The Scream. The Forbes article goes on to muse about the subjectivity and the value of such rare pieces of the solar system, and that the primary reason for price increases is driven by the very human emotion each evokes. The Scream Gibeon, which ultimately didn't sell in 2012 for Pitt's price, is not the only piece of Gibeon that has been part of the Makovic collection, as another relatively large piece of Gibeon with the natural-looking holes that cuts right through its center has also been featured in the rare collection. Smaller, uncut Gibeon fragments can also be found on meteorite exchanges, selling only a couple cubic centimeters for over $100. Like Willamette, the Gibeon meteorite pieces are being cut up and sold too. The Gibeon is a very stable iron meteorite, which means that it is not prone to rust or corrosion as easily as other iron meteorites, and so it is highly coveted. All iron meteorites, including the Gibeon and Willamette, reveal unique and beautiful patterns known as Widmanstätten patterns when etched with acid after they are cut. Therefore, they are sold either cut, uncut, or sometimes both together. One antique site has an uncut piece of the Gibeon meteorite about 7 inches in length with a sliced 2-square-inch piece of Gibeon etched with Widmanstätten patterns, which together was selling for $34,500. Another uncut piece of Gibeon measuring over 1 foot in length sold on Bonhams for $17,500, while an 8-inch slice of etched Gibeon sold separately for $1,402. Christie's sold a 9.5-inch long uncut piece of Gibeon for over $17,000, and an etched 4-inch slice for $6,875. Bonhams featured meteorite in a 2015 auction was a life-sized skull carved out of the Gibeon meteorite by the American artist Lee Downey, who has sculpted skulls out of other rare material, including bowling balls, jets, and even mammoth ivory. The Widmanstätten patterns stand out beautifully, a truly one-of-a-kind item that was listed for $300,000 to $400,000. Carving skulls from Gibeon meteorites has become a popular thing, as miniature skulls have been carved out of millimeter-sized pieces of Gibeon that are sold for hundreds of dollars. Chapter 14, Part 4, Achondrites, the Moon, Mars, and the Ethics of Meteorites. Iron meteorites, like Willamette and Gibeon, are more rare than the standard chondrite meteorite, and why they often go for such high prices, particularly because of their weight and Widmanstätten patterns, but they are not the most expensive meteorites. The most expensive meteorites tend to be achondrites of varying sorts, with the ones that come from Mars or the Moon as the most highly prized. Pieces of Mars, the size of pebbles, sell for thousands of dollars, and why the American Museum of Natural History was so willing to trade 28 pounds of Willamette for mere ounces of Mars. The most famous Martian meteorite is known as Zagami. The 40 pounds of red planet made its way into a Nigerian farmer's field and crashed mere feet from the owner as he was at work in 1962. It is the largest Martian meteorite to date and caught the attention of the father of meteorite hunters, Robert Hagg. Hagg had apparently traded a complete meteorite collection for just a 6-pound piece of Zagami, and then he proceeded to cut it up and distribute it. Hagg's deal is why Zagami is one of the easiest pieces of Martian meteorites for collectors to get a hold of today. Astronomy.com called Hagg the best-known meteorite dealer in the world in 2003. And in an article about Daryl Pitt and the Makovic collection, they interviewed Robert Hagg to prove Pitt's credibility. Hagg said of Pitt, quote, "There is no one who has done more to popularize meteorites than Daryl, except me." End quote. The further you look into Robert Hagg, the easier it is to see how he ties nearly the entire meteorite world together. His website, which is unsurprisingly meteorites.com, features a banner with a close-up of Hagg's upper face in a fishing hat, wearing sunglasses that is reflecting a giant fireball heading towards Earth. Hagg posts an annual catalog of meteorites in his collection, and in the 2020 edition, the first picture in the catalog appears to be of a young Hagg holding up a set of large iron meteorites from Australia with a big smile on his face. After that introductory photo, Hagg begins to show photos of his impressive meteorite collection, beginning with a 13-pound meteorite, presumably in his own outstretched arms, with the tattoo, "We are all made of stardust," written on his inner forearm. Other impressive samples appear as you proceed through the catalog, including a rare piece of the famed Allende carbonaceous chondrite, a handful of Aguas Zarcas samples, a 12-gram Murchison, 946 grams of Milbolili, and 1,504 grams of the Canyon Diablo meteorite from Meteor Crater in Arizona. Then there are Hag's Gibeon meteorites on page 10, which features a nearly 20-pound highly polished Gibeon so shiny that it's reflective. There is a 150-gram working nut and bolt made out of Gibeon, a 5-pound Gibeon sphere, two small Gibeon conchos, a 303-gram etched Gibeon sword, and two forged Gibeon Damascus knives, reminiscent of King Tut's own meteoritic blade. There are very few collectors on the planet who could rival Hag's 2020 catalog, let alone his entire meteorite collection. In 1991, a much younger 35-year-old Hag was featured in a Los Angeles Times article, where he was interviewed in the huge vault beneath his home near Tucson to show off what was then considered the only privately owned piece of the moon. Yes, it's true that there had been moon rocks collected from the Apollo missions, and yes, it's also true that lunar meteorites had been found before Hag's, but those were primarily found on Antarctica, which made nearly all the moon rocks owned by the governments of the United States and Japan. Upon taking possession of the meteorite featured in the LA Times, Hag, with his trained eye, knew immediately that he likely had a moon rock and took it to the University of Arizona to have its composition analyzed. At only 19 grams, the piece could easily fit in the palm of his hand. And results from the university indicated that it had the exact same chemical signature that the moon rocks from the Apollo missions had, making its lunar origin official. The 1991 LA Times article ends with, quote, "Collectors are known to pay high premiums for rare meteorites, and Hag has the rarest one in private hands. Someday," he said, grinning broadly, "I may sell it." End quote. In Hag's 2020 catalog, the last page is reserved for the special achondrites from other planets, including a 2.7-gram piece of the Martian Zagami and a 15-gram piece of lunar meteorite. While Hag does not put prices next to his featured space rocks, other auctions have provided information on how much people will pay for a slice of the moon. In a 2012 auction, which sold a 96-pound piece of the Canyon Diablo meteorite for $27,500 and a 9-inch uncut Gibeon that sold for $46,000, a pair of 9-inch slices of the moon that were made available to the public sold for $330,000. In 2018, someone purchased a 12-pound lunar meteorite for over $612,000. In January 2017, over 227 pounds of lunar meteorites were found littered across the Western Sahara, with the largest piece of the group weighing in at 30 pounds, making it the fifth largest piece, and eventually it sold on Christie's for $2.5 million. Clearly, achondrites from the moon or Mars stand above chondrites and irons in the eyes of collectors. Hag undoubtedly inspired an entire generation of meteorite hunters, and it's because of his start that people like Farmer, Ward, and Pitt had also gotten into the meteorite exchange business. Hag trailblazed the capitalist meteorite market with unprecedented success. Having been in the meteorite business before nearly anyone else, Hag was able to find and acquire meteorites from all over the world and create a market for people to buy and sell them. But there were benefits to Hag's business model that weren't strictly related to profit. He may have collected the Zagami meteorite and cut it up into pieces to make money, but he also took it to a university to be verified and entered into the Global Registry for Meteorites with details about its origin, composition, and size. And by cutting Zagami up, many people were able to get a hold of a piece of Mars rather than one collector hiding it away. Legitimate arguments can be made about dividing a meteorite into more pieces for more people to enjoy and making a profit from the many smaller pieces. Following the example set by Hag, meteorite hunters like Farmer and Ward also have their finds verified through universities, sometimes even donating to them. This protocol allows the market to effectively contribute to science while still being able to be a successful business model. If meteorites could not be bought and sold, then theoretically there would be less incentive for hunters to go out and find them. Just as Farmer gave more money to the family of the Aguas Zarcas meteorite when he found out its value, Hag also prides himself on compensating others for putting in the work and finding meteorites for him. It can seem like a win-win-win for everyone involved. But there are competing views to the capitalist meteorite collection method, perhaps best highlighted by the event that made Robert Hag famous to begin with, that occurred even before the discovery of his lunar meteorite. Hag caught global attention when the Associated Press published the article on February 16, 1990, entitled "American Accused of Meteorite Theft Leaves Argentina." Hag, only 33 at the time, had been arrested for transporting a meteorite out of the country, which he had no legal right in taking. Hag told officials that he had made a deal with an Argentinian who agreed to arrange the sale of the meteorite with the owner of whose land it was on. But when the police stopped Hag on his way out of the country with it, they told him the meteorite is a national treasure and that Hag had no right to take it. The meteorite was confiscated, and Hag was sent to jail for 6 days, but was released to tend to, as Hag put it, his $500,000 of business a year buying and selling meteorites. AP led the article with this quote from Hag: "I've got my passport, and I'm out of here." While at first it may seem little more than a bizarre, lost-in-translation story of a novel meteorite hunter, a quaint idea in 1990 when the meteorite collection business was highly obscure. The meteorite in question is worth understanding a little better. The meteorite that Hag was transporting out of the country was about half of the 100,000-pound Campo del Cielo iron meteorite, which broke up over the northern plains of Argentina a few thousand years ago. Pieces have been incrementally discovered and recorded since the time of the 16th century Spanish conquest. A comparable and slightly larger piece of the same meteorite was discovered in 2016, buried underground, making it the largest meteorite ever discovered in the Americas, even larger than the Willamette. At the time that Hag was trying to take his piece of Campo del Cielo out of the country, he was possibly removing the largest known meteorite in the Americas. AP reports on his quirky nickname of Meteorite Man before they report on Hag's most telling quote, where he says, "I could have gotten $1 million for it." So then it's worth wondering how legitimate Hag's financial arrangement was with the Argentine Miguel Fernandez, who coincidentally was unable to post his $8,600 bail to Hag's $20,000, which Hag was ultimately freed from. The AP article gives no further details about Fernandez, and no subsequent articles on Hag seem to inquire too deeply about the incident. But it does seem a little fishy that the person Hag had arranged to buy one of the largest meteorites in the world from didn't have the money to post bail, and nor was Hag willing to post bail for him. The 1991 LA Times article on the lunar meteorite merely quoted what they called one source who is familiar with the case, that it was the classic case of someone selling the Brooklyn Bridge. Of course, it's plausible that Hag was making a Scouts Honor legitimate business deal while Miguel Fernandez was the real scoundrel. But the quote, "I could have gotten $1 million, does seem a good enough reason for Hag to look for an alleged legitimate business deal, where there wasn't necessarily one. Just as Aguas Zarcas and the Willamette were taken from their landing site, Hag almost single-handedly lifted one of the largest meteorites on the planet from Argentina, where he would have been the exclusive owner. With hindsight, this can be seen as the meteor equivalent of Hag attempting to rob a casino in broad daylight. In 2014, an Argentinian documentary came out by Sergio Wolf called The Color Out of Space, which explores meteor hunting in Argentina, particularly the Campo del Cielo meteorite. Wolf makes a trip to Tucson and is invited into the home of Hag and interviews him about his career, his 1990 Argentina misadventure, and the large piece of the meteorite that landed him in jail. As Hag brings the camera crew into his home, the documentary features rare and unique meteorites from all around the world, including one he uses to jump off of into his pool, which is easily capable of going for thousands of dollars on the market. One review of the documentary hints that Wolf even nudges, quote, Hag to do something which would actually provide solid evidence of his wrongdoing for that heist-like operation from 24 years ago, end quote. With a quarter century having passed since its occurrence, anything the documentary could prove in relation to Hag's possible less-than-honest transaction likely had little effect on him. Hag proclaimed that being arrested in Argentina was the best thing that could have happened to him in the 1991 LA Times interview featuring the Moon Rock. He gloated about how the global media attention and that his arrest in Argentina doubled his business to over $1 million the previous year. Meteorites are finite and pose some moral and legal questions. There are likely less than 1 million meteorite pieces on the planet, and they all provide some invaluable scientific information about the universe. Should meteorite buyers be able to swarm in from around the planet to pick them up and take them away to sell for a profit? Different countries have different stances. Denmark considers them fossil troves that by default belong to the state. Australia, Canada, Chile, France, Mexico, and New Zealand require state approval to export it from the country. But in places like Costa Rica and Oregon, there is no interference by the government at all. The drawback to this laissez-faire meteorite capitalism is that these private buyers and sellers aren't required to take them anywhere for registration. With a trained eye, a person can know how to spot most legitimates from the fakes. Once in private hands, they can get cut up, sculpted, etched, and sold, their natural fallen state disfigured and placed in private collections all over the planet. But without the collecting business, there wouldn't be the same incentive to find the vast majority of meteorites that have already been found. In Wolf's documentary, Hag is a free market believer and proud of the compensation he gives to those who find meteorites for him, plainly stating that, quote, if it's worth money, people will go look for it. If it's not worth money, they don't care, end quote. In 2011, 8 years before the fall of Aguas Zarcas, Mike Farmer and Robert Ward were together in the desert of Oman searching for meteorites. As meteorite law is so often only developed after a complication occurs, Oman still had no legal standard for meteorites, and Farmer and Ward weren't going to wait around for one with a good desert to hunt. And the desert of Oman provided, revealing several valuable meteorites on their hunt. Farmer found a $45,000 moon rock, and Ward found a 100-pound meteorite worth about $60,000. Overall, it was a good haul, as the pair collected what Farmer figured was close to $2 million in space rock by the end of their trip. After 2 weeks of meteorite hunting in Omen, police stopped Farmer and Ward, saw the 100-pound meteorite in the back, and instantly sent the pair to jail for illegal mining charges. The prisons of Omen are not where anyone would want to find themselves under any circumstances, and Farmer and Ward wallowed there for 54 days. They were only finally freed after their lawyer proved that picking rocks up from the surface isn't the same thing as mining. The meteorites were confiscated, and the pair were banned from returning to Omen. These nightmare scenarios are not unusual for meteorite hunters to find themselves in. Several months later, Farmer took another meteorite hunting trip, this time to Kenya, where he was ultimately kidnapped, beaten, robbed, and almost killed when trying to purchase meteorites. These are not exotic vacations spent behind the walls of a resort. Meteorite hunters genuinely put their life on the line and can return home with nothing, even if they do get home safely, making each hunt a financial risk as well. A good argument can be made for financially incentivizing the hunt, but what legal obligation should the hunter have to the meteorite when it's found? Do we rely on the goodwill of people like Farmer, Ward, and Hag to bring it to scientific institutions at their whim? Or should financial compensation for hunting be entirely restricted and any meteorite found be subject to registration, identification, experimentation, and put on display or studied by the state, like they are in Denmark? Perhaps a middle ground could be reached. A global agreement made where meteorites need to be analyzed by a university or lab in the country of origin, and thus registered free of charge with any cross-border transportation of meteorites, coming with a realistic fee that is a fraction of the estimated cost of the rock, using averages based on real sales of known similar meteorites. While the rock may not always stay in its country of origin, the country of origin could still financially benefit from being part of an otherwise free market system with some sort of reasonable fee. But if that doesn't work, then perhaps other alternatives that still allow for registry, scientific advancement in meteoritics, and fair compensation for work can be reached. Thank you for listening to this episode of No Character Limit. Every episode, the sources that I used are located in the description if you would like to check them out. In addition, please consider liking, rating, and reviewing if you enjoyed this podcast, as each one goes to help further the reach of this podcast for new people to hear. Each episode requires hours in research, writing, recording, and editing. So if you feel that what you just heard is worth a donation of any size, please go to the description and follow the links for that. Each donation comes with a free PDF copy of a writing piece of your choice, no matter the size of your donation, and you get a lot of extra features with that, including a lot of the artwork and graphs and pictures, as well as the descriptions that I don't include in the podcast. If you would like updates for new episodes, you can follow No Character Limit at mastodon.world. And finally, if you have a question, comment, or even a correction, please feel free to reach out at nocharacterlimit@protonmail.com. Thank you again for listening.